This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, Craig Lubo hosts special guest Biagio Pagano. They will discuss biodiversity and how it clashes with our economic system. But first, I'm Natural Lee with your environmental news. KSDK.com reports, Missouri would regulate and license the growing of industrial hemp as a raw material for manufacturing under a measure supporters say is an economic development measure. The Missouri House gave initial approval Tuesday to a bill that would legalize the cultivation of hemp, which contains very low levels of the psychoactive chemical found in marijuana. Republican Representative Paul Kurtman of Pacific says many products are made with hemp that must be imported from foreign countries. He says there's no danger that the measure would allow easier access to marijuana. Businesses seeking to grow hemp would have to go through a licensing process and undergo a background check. The crop would be subject to inspection. FultonSun.com reports, Thursday, the Missouri Coalition for the Environment filed an appeal to Ameren Missouri's Callaway Energy Center's license extension, which the U.S. Nuclear Regulator Commission, or NRC, granted last month. While the environmental group's appeal would not immediately affect the Callaway Nuclear Facilities license, MCE and court documents state it would serve as a, quote, placeholder, end quote, contention, so that later court decisions could have the potential to affect its license. MCE Safe Energy Director Ed Smith said the organization feels that placeholder contention is necessary because the legal adequacy of an NRC rule regarding how spent nuclear fuel is stored long-term is currently contested in the U.S. Court of Appeals. Smith added that MCE is not asking the NRC to permanently deny the Callaway Energy Center's license renewal request. Quote, we are simply asking the court to make sure that the Callaway Nuclear Reactor's license is not extended pending the outcome of this spent nuclear fuel waste litigation, end quote, Smith said. While the Callaway plant received a license extension from the NRC on March 6th, it has expected to hear an NRC decision regarding its license extension request in December. However, MCE filed contentions in December that put the license renewal on hold. Last month, the commissioners decided to renew the plant's license despite those contentions, which were still pending before the NRC commissioners until Thursday. The commissions denied the environmental group's December request to intervene in the CEC's license renewal, stating that the request was out of the scope of license renewal proceedings. The South Dakota Public Utilities Commission said on Monday, April 27th, that it has granted interveners' motion for a continuance, which will effectively delay the scheduled May 4th through 8th Keystone XL permit application evidentiary hearing and public comment session. Bold, Nebraska, and a number of Nebraska landowners who live on the proposed pipeline route are among the parties granted official intervener status in TransCanada's PUC permit application process. The evidentiary hearing is now expected to be rescheduled for late July or early August, with the exact dates to be set at the PUC hearing on Thursday, April 30th. Statement from Jane Klebe of Bold, Nebraska, quote, citizens and allied tribal nations worked to ensure more time was given to address the serious risks to water on the current route in South Dakota, as well as the lack of proper spill response planning. The South Dakota PUC listened to our concerns, and the delay of the hearing is welcomed news. TransCanada should take note. Their pipeline is delayed for so long because it is risky and, simply put, will never be built. We remain united and urge the president to reject Keystone XL once and for all, end quote. To see the motion for continuance and more information, visit the boldnebraska.org link posted on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page. And finally, on Earth Day, scores of people from around our state all met at the Capitol building in Jefferson City for Earth Day Lobby Day. We spoke with senators and representatives, encouraging our legislators to support renewable energy and energy efficiency to address climate change and meet the requirements of the EPA's proposed Clean Power Plan. You'll hear from the rally on next week's Eco Radio program, so be sure to tune in. At this time, I'd like to welcome Craig Lubo to the mic.
Hey, thank you, Naturally. I am here with my guest, Biagio Pagano, and he has a background in public health and environment. He has a master's degree from University of Missouri in Columbia. The focus of his academics has been defense prevention, health promotion, biological sciences, and environmental epidemiology. He has 30 years of experience working for the Kansas Department of Health and Environment and the Wyandotte County Public Health Department, and currently is on the adjunct faculty at Kansas City Art Institute, Baker University, and Park University, where he teaches environmental sciences. Welcome, Biagio.
Thank you. It's a real honor to be here.
Okay. We're going to be talking about biodiversity and the relationship of economics and the environmental worldview relating to biodiversity. Before we get into specifics, I think you said you could give us an overview of the topic.
Yes, thank you. I will do that. Of course, biodiversity is a very complex science. It's a component of biological sciences, especially in the field of ecological sciences and environmental biology. But I will talk about biodiversity, what that is, the different components of biodiversity, some examples of biological and economic life-giving benefits of biodiversity on a global level and on an individual level, how we actually interfere and reduce the benefits of biodiversity because of human-related or anthropogenic-related activities that basically negatively impact on our global environment. Also, some discussion about the limitations of our existing economic systems and some recommendations that are made by environmental economists and the economists that look at things in a more broader scope from a sustainable perspective, and what has been done historically to reduce the extinction and the degradation of our life support systems, and what we as societies can do to be more responsible, what individuals can do to be more responsible as well in terms of protecting our resources. And I'm glad that you mentioned that I do teach at Baker University, Park University, and Kansas City Art Institute. When I first taught these courses, I wasn't sure exactly how the students would react to it, but it's been very heartwarming. At Baker University, nearly all of my students over there are business majors, and but that was no clash at all. They really welcomed the information. They found it very interesting, and they incorporated many of the things that they learned in the class, in the classroom, into their business practices and in their own lives, too. The Art Institute, I may not take credit for this, but there is a student organization called Alternative Means, and it's a student-centered initiative where they're looking at things like finding ways to reduce energy costs on campus, looking at foods more, incorporating more healthier foods, and educating students and faculty and members about the importance of organic produce, the health benefits, and things like that, looking at ways to minimize waste and energy and matter resources. So I'm really proud of the things that are being done, and shows me that there's some hope. So those are kind of the areas I want to get into.
Dealing with the economics, what are the benefits of biodiversity to our economy?
Okay, the benefits are innumerable, and I think we can start off by just basically helping your listening audience understand what biodiversity is. And look at this as sort of like the variety of every living organism, all the species and the different life forms, the genes that they contain, the ecosystems that they live in, and the ecosystem processes of energy flow and nutrient cycling that sustain all life. And there's different components of that. You have what's called species diversity, which is the number and abundance of species that are present in the different ecological communities. They could be aquatic ecosystems. They could be terrestrial and forest and places like that. Genetic diversity is also a very important concept, too. It's the variety of genetic material within species or a population. There's functional diversity, which is the biogeochemical processes such as energy flow and matter recycling needed for the survival of all systems and organisms. And also, last but not least, is ecological diversity, the variety of aquatic and terrestrial ecosystems found. So we're talking about abundance. The greater the abundance of all of these four components and the greater the amount of biodiversity, the healthier the planet is, the greater the benefits to our economic systems, to human health. And we as a population, as global citizens, need to understand more of that and appreciate that and reduce our impact on that. So, but your question dealing with what are the benefits or what are some of the benefits, I can give you a few here. If you look at just the plant world, which is the forests, grasslands, oceanic phytoplankton, they provide all the life-giving oxygen that we all need. They also sequester a variety of different types of air pollutants, also responsible for balancing the equation of photosynthesis and cellular respiration, things like that. the forest, something that people don't understand is that they help to recharge large amounts of aquifers, which are underground sources of water. And the groundwater provides about 50% of all the drinking water in the world. And in the United States, the U.S. aquifers supply nearly all the drinking water in the rural areas, and about a fifth in the urban areas as well, about 37% of the country's irrigation water. That's quite significant. So to give you an example, when we take those forests away, you you basically destroy the ability of the aquifers getting recharged because of the forest population. Food production, can't speak enough about that, but just very quickly, just mentioning that our croplands produce mostly grains and they provide 77% of the world's food. Rangelands and pastures provide about 16% of the world's food production. and fisheries and aquaculture provide about another 7%. The oceanic ecosystems, an amazing biological system that are very detailed, very complex. We're talking about estuaries, coral reefs, things like that, and the oceans cover 71% of our Earth's surface, and about 1 billion people worldwide in developing countries depend on fish as their primary source of protein. About 90% of the people living in developing nations depend on fishing as their livelihood. It generates about $102 billion annually in about 85 countries. And coral reefs produce about $172 billion in revenue annually in different ways, and pollution control, flood prevention, things like that. I take this topic rather personally. I had a niece, my niece, who was diagnosed with cancer, a childhood form of leukemia. And she was literally saved from chemicals that came from a plant that is found only on the island of Madagascar. It's called the rosy periwinkle, found no place else on planet Earth. And it's called vinblastine and vincristine, and they're used for treating acute childhood leukemia. Other examples, like what we take for granted, like just the simple aspirin. Aspirin comes from a tropical willow tree, very important in terms of a painkiller, reducing inflammation, reduces the risk of colorectal cancer, is a anticoagulant, reducing the risks of strokes, heart attacks, things of that nature. Sweet clover, and there's different species, for example, of sweet clover, but they developed warfarin, which is an anticoagulant that prevents clots from forming and alleviates also pulmonary embolisms, any clots that can form in the lungs, which happened to me. And so that was an amazing thing. We get venoms from spiders and snakes, you know, for pain relief. Hypertension medicine, medications that we use to treat AIDS, and it just goes on and on and on regarding the benefits of everything like that.
Now, you mentioned venoms from spiders and snakes. Mm-hmm. Are we talking about just venoms that we think of in terms of anti-venoms for snake bites, or are we talking about something else?
No, something that you can actually get, and they tweak it a little bit synthetically, but they have made a very powerful clot-dissolving compound called TPA, which is tissue plasminogen activator, and it's used to treat patients who have had occlusive-based strokes and embolisms. So it's been very successful. They're also doing some additional work in terms of pain relief and all that. And by the way, morphine, when used legally, of course, you know, is a very powerful pain-killing compound. They have also found a secretion on the skin of a particular frog that is found in the Amazonian basin, where the pain-killing benefits are 50 times more effective than morphine without the side effects. But it takes a long time for the pharmaceutical companies to get the information in the natural world, collect these plants, animals, and insects, do the testing on human subjects, animals. It takes anywhere from 15 years to 25 years. And for every medication that's out there, it costs the pharmaceutical companies about $1 billion. Medication. So it's a very costly initiative.
And when we're talking about deforestation, we're talking mm-hmm. about not just the impact of the plants, but the habitat for these, for the spiders and snakes, et cetera.
Correct. Yeah, okay. Correct. Habitat destruction is actually the major reason for extinction. And that's one. Invasive species that we introduce either accidentally or intentionally also has a also reduces biodiversity.
We do need to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
The following is a test of the emergency alert system, brought to you as a public service of 90.1 FM KKFI. Again, the following is only a test of the emergency alert system. What you just heard was a test from the emergency alert system. It was only a test. In the event of an emergency, it would have been followed with further instructions. Thank you for your patience. From 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City.
Greetings! This is your friend Pop Freeling, host of the Groove Juice Special Sunday mornings from 8 to 9. Bringing you totally inspirational, wholly motivational, kind of confrontational, cross-generational celebrations each week with songs, guests, happenings, and all types of audio entertainment for kids and anyone else out there who doesn't care to grow up. Live every Sunday at 8 in the morning at 90.1 KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
Okay, we're back, and again we are talking to Biagio Pagano, and we are talking about biodiversity. And welcome back again.
Thank you.
We would talk about the economic benefits, mm-hmm. and also let's talk about the economic cost, Ben.
Okay.
When we have destruction of the biodiversity, mm-hmm. what are some of the costs in terms of health care issues and environmental costs?
There are costs. Some of them are much easier to quantify. But I did want to finish saying that there's multiple reasons why we're pushing species to extinction or reducing their populations. And I did mention habitat destruction, invasive species. The population of our planet is growing uncontrollably right now. It's 1.2% per year. So unchecked exponential population growth is an issue, pollution and overexploitation. The economic benefits, let me just kind of give you an example. Like the honeybee, which is under assault right now here in North America, provides somewhere around $15 to $20 billion worth of agricultural productivity. Their numbers are declining seriously, and If we lose that species, or if we cripple that species to the point where they cannot function biologically and give us the benefits through pollination and all that, not only would it reduce food, but it would also have an impact on agricultural productivity and the economics of growing food. And the same thing with coral reefs, for example, and estuaries. Coral reefs are amazing biosystems, ecosystems that help to prevent floods, slow down the tidal waves that come into an area. Oftentimes they are referred to as the rainforest of the sea because there's so many species of fish and aquatic organisms that have actually helped so much in our meeting the needs of our population. But there are some concerns as to what is going on from the perspective of economics. And one of the things is, and let's kind of start with what is economics. It's the production, distribution, and the consumption of goods and services to satisfy the needs and wants of populations. And when you look at the neoclassical approach of economics and the systems that we're using, they're somewhat outdated. In fact, they're critically outdated. The natural capital, which are all of the ecosystems on our planet, is viewed as a subset of the economic system itself rather than the other way around. If it wasn't for these biological processes, they are the ones that actually underpin our economies, the corporations, human health, give us the food production, the medicines that we all need. And economists from the neoclassical perspective do not honor or see that kind of relationship. And so there's a growing number of ecologists that have also studied economics, and they're saying that resources are limited and they should never be wasted or used unsustainably. Because when you look at the old system says that all of our ecosystems are unlimited. We have the right to exploit that only for human needs. So there's a really big clash there. And any kind of waste or pollution that is produced as a result of that will always be degraded because of microbial activity and things like that. And they cannot be more wrong on that. So we should be looking at ways to reduce the harm to our ecosystems, recognizing how we need to look at things more sustainably. And the way that we go, may I mention how we do that? Okay.
Yes.
The way that we do that is, for example, we have to use a more comprehensive economic indicator to determine what is economic viability between one nation and another. Right now, we're using the GDP, which is the gross domestic product, as a way of accounting for economic growth. But that does not distinguish between goods and services that are environmentally or socially beneficial and from those that are harmful. an example of that would be, let's just take tobacco, for example, the number of people that smoke cigarettes. Whenever there are tobacco-related illnesses, deaths, or things like that, absenteeism, those costs are not inculcated in determining the GDP. In fact, it shows as an economic boom because the tobacco companies have made quite a fortune on something like that. And another example would be like when you take out, let's say, 500,000 acres of a forest and you build a subdivision there, they don't look at the value, the biological value of the forest and all the biodiversity benefits of that. They just see that as a single economic source of dollars, you know, that the developers get. And I'm not trying to paint a picture that all corporations are evil. There's a growing number of corporations that are trying to do the right thing, use sustainable approaches, finding ways to minimize energy and matter resources. And I have a couple examples I can talk about a little bit later. So anyway, so a more accurate indicator would be, for example, like the GPI, which is the General Progress Indicator, and there's also another one called the ISEW, the Index for Sustainable Economic Welfare. So when we use that in calculating our economic strength, they take into consideration, for example, the loss of our topsoil because of unsustainable agriculture, the pollution of our air and water, uncontrolled deforestation, and the cost of treating environmental-related illnesses. When those things are brought into the formula, you have something that's more comprehensive, and it shows that we've actually had a decline in economic viability since the 1950s, as opposed to seeing an increase in economic strength because we don't incorporate the other realities there. So that's one of the things that we can do is move towards a more accurate accounting system. The other thing we can do is use eco-labeling. You probably have heard that before. Identify the products that are produced by environmentally sound methods and educating consumers about that so that they can make informed choices.
And with this, are you envisioning something similar to like your nutrition labels, only a label indicating the environmental impact?
Exactly. And many of the retail outlets, you know, that sell foods that are organically grown, they do a really good job in alerting the public regarding GMOs, that it's pesticide-free. And they have to go through a very rigorous process of certification from the Department of Agriculture. Here's the one that really kind of bothers me, is that we're using a lot of our taxpayer money to subsidize harmful industries, the fossil fuel industry or the nuclear industry. We know that there are detrimental effects to that, but the ones who are wanting to do all the right things, especially like the organic farmers, they get no subsidies at all. In fact, it costs more for them, you know, to produce products. So we can level that out more effectively if we can provide them with more of the subsidies that would be beneficial for them and cost effective for the population. So, also too, how about taxes, okay? We tax wages, income, and wealth. How about taxing, instead of those things, taxing pollution, the amount of pollution that is being generated, resource waste, environmentally harmful goods and services, which would give corporations an economic incentive to make some changes, and also to award those industries that are trying to do the right thing. They want to maintain some degree of responsibility and help them economically in some ways. So anyway, those are some examples. You know, how about selling more services instead of things, and also make products more durable so they don't have to be continually recycled or thrown in a landfill, but if there's durability built into everything, whether it's cars or furniture, you know, products that we buy that we believe makes our life a little easier, you know, make it more durable so you don't have to go through the constant use of taking virgin raw materials from nature to do that.
Now, how do you balance that with some people who say if you make it too durable, that, okay, you help save the environment, but you put a lot of people in the unemployment lines because they don't need as many people. So how do you balance growth in the economy with the environment?
It's an ongoing challenge, and that's why there's been this discrepancy between the pro-growth economists and the economists that want to do things more sustainably. This is where I think we could use the power of subsidies. We could also use the power of educating the public to buy products that are more sustainable, so that might be a boom to their economy, to their businesses. We could also save taxes. If we can save our resources through more environmental protection and reduce the tax load, then that would free up more money for our population to buy products that are made sustainably. It's a challenge. There's still pieces that need to be worked out, and I think this is where the economists can come in and really make a difference. And I know traditionally the ecological community and the economists have always been at odds with each other. I personally believe that it doesn't have to be that way. There's, you know, we could have a win-win situation. I want to kind of give an example of a sustainable industry.
Before we get into the example, we do need to take another break. When we come back from this break, we will take a few phone calls, and the number to call when we come back is 816-931 5534.
This Tuesday at 6 p.m. is Transit Talk on Radioactive Magazine. Host Janet Rogers talks with KCATA's new CEO, Joe Reardon, about his vision for the region's transit system, and KCATA's Vice President of Operations, Sam Dessou, about safety on the Metro. Join us Tuesday at 6 p.m. on Radioactive Magazine on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
More useful than corporate media's battling soundbites approach to covering TPP would be journalism that got outside the Beltway and talked to people about what the fallout from these corporate-centered international agreements really look like. Counterspin fills in some of these blanks Tuesday, 6:30 p.m.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections.
I think to react to the climate crisis, we need to go from what we know about the climate to how do we feel about the climate.
That's artist Olafur Eliasson. In October 2014, he had 12 giant blocks of glacier ice, each about the size of a car, shipped from Greenland to Copenhagen. He arranged them in a clock formation right outside the town hall where the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, was meeting about the latest science. Called Ice Watch, his exhibit melted away in public. Eliasson says many people came up, touched the ice, and then stood there quietly, just watching and feeling.
Once they actually stood there physically confronted to the ice, they were stunned. And the fact that the weather in Copenhagen also made the ice melt even faster created that slight drama that it was clear to everybody, oh, the ice is not necessarily going to be here for another day or two.
Eliasson hopes the experience provided an emotional context for the IPCC's scientific report.
I think art is such a strong ambassador for translating thinking into doing.
Eliasson hopes to bring a new Ice Watch sculpture to Paris during the World Climate Negotiations in November. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
All right, welcome back. Again, we are here with Biagio Pagano, and we are talking about biodiversity, and we've been talking about economic impacts. I want to go back to one of the things you mentioned at the beginning when you were talking about the four components of biodiversity. If you could, in layman's term, is at least I'm confused somewhat, and maybe some of the listeners might be, what is the difference between the species component and the genetic component?
The genetic is all the genetic information that we get from the gene pool of plants and animals that would be a benefit to us. And nature has a way of strengthening their own species. Let me give an example. Let's say you have a particular plant that is under bombardment from, let's say, insect predation, okay, from herbivorous insects. Okay, the way that the plant protects itself, the way that they protect itself, is by increasing the natural load of pesticides over a period of time, over generations, to deal with the onslaught of the insect. And the insects, in turn, what they do is they find a way to counter the defenses of the plant. And it's called coevolution. And so when this occurs, what happens is that you strengthen the genetic value of both species. And so when we delve and we look into those types of chemicals that are found in plants, like, for example, like phytochemicals, that's a perfect example of how we could use those compounds to reduce the risk of cancers and heart disease and things like that. So that would be the genetic. And the other part you were mentioning is ecological diversity?
The difference between genetic and species.
Yeah, species is the variety of different species. The more species you have, the greater the gene pool and the greater the ecological resources that you would have within any given biome or ecosystem. Right. So in other words, the key word here is abundance. Abundance, variety, and all the connections and reactions that insects and plants, soil all have in common and all together.
Okay. We do have a caller on the line. Caller, if you could just state your first name and what part of the city you're calling from.
JP from Shawnee.
Okay. And what's your question?
Great show. Thank you for the show.
Well, thank you.
Very informative guest.
Thank you.
What realistically can be done, given the juggernaut of power that the 1% in Wall Street has over our politicians, to actually make a meaningful difference in protecting the planet? Thanks.
I think that's an excellent question. It's not something that will happen overnight. But I'm a real believer that when you empower people, the citizens, local communities, and individuals through knowledge, and you empower them politically, that they can go ahead and vote for the right candidates. They can make the right choices on the products they think can buy. They could lobby against certain practices. They don't have to purchase something that is environmentally destructive. So, you know, our dollar can count for one thing. And I think that's a very good question. So it's all of these things. But the real thing that's missing right now is a vast amount of education that is needed for a population to become aware of these issues and the different avenues that they can take. Sometimes environmental organizations may lobby against a particular process, a company, or whatever, and they may not always provide really viable alternatives in working together rather than working adversarially against each other is to work more cooperatively and really push your policymakers, your politicians, your heads of state, your corporations to make these changes. And I think it was Margaret Mead that said, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, that, and she was an anthropologist, that to really see change only takes a handful of very informed and dedicated individuals to see a change occur. And even my business students at Baker University are very good at enlightening me that if a company gets, let's say they get notices from 5 to 10% of their population about a dissatisfaction of a product or something like that, you know, that's enough to make a change with some of them and to move in a really good direction and make our politicians accountable. Maybe looking at campaign finance reform. Campaign finance reform in its purest sense would allow the average person to provide as much as a corporation can, you know, if you set it at a limit, like maybe $1,000 or $2,000 or something like that. So one major corporation can't put in $30,000 or $40,000. Everything should be pretty much equal. That way, the money does not push the policies or the legislation. It's the power of the argument itself and what is good for the population and what is good for the planet. So if we do the right things from a planetary perspective, it's just going to be that much better for our societies, our human societies. I hope that answers this question.
I think it sounds like it, Dan.
Okay.
One additional factor I would suggest is that some environmental organizations are pushing socially responsible investing so that when
Correct.
You invest, you're investing in mutual funds that are socially responsible, environmentally minded companies. And if you're a shareholder in a big corporation, you can also go to your shareholder meetings, and if there's enough environmentalists there, you can have an impact on what that corporation does.
Okay. I totally agree. I think it's a great idea. I should have thought of that.
So we have another caller on the line. Caller, if you'd state your first name and what part of the city you're calling from.
Yeah, this is Toby from Prairie Village.
Hi, Toby.
Hello.
Hello, guys. Yeah, I thought I heard a statistic there. I was kind of out there in the yard doing some planting some vegetables. I heard a statistic that I wanted to run by you because it may actually challenge what you said earlier. Psychology Today magazine, October 2012, was a great issue because the psychologists are starting to make the link between autism and cognitive spectrum disorders or cognitive disorders, rather. And the whole article is about herbicides and pesticides. And one of the facts that they relayed that really stuck out to me, because going through Kansas and the Great Plains, you see that, you know, one farmer feeds X amount of people and the United States feeds the world. The statistic they had here was that the U.S. uses 22% of the world's pesticides to produce 4% of the world's agricultural output. So that was something that we ran around the Food Circle folks and the ag folks. I called over to WIBW, the Ag Radio Network. Kelly Lenz talked to him over there. And nobody could really quantify where that came from, although we did find a blog at PANA.org, PANA.org, that referenced this item that we're only producing 4% of the world's agricultural output. So I just wanted to get your opinion on that.
Well, of course, you have all these different ways of producing food. The thing I think to remember here is that pesticides in the long run are not sustainable because the insect population is always going to be one step ahead of humans in terms of being genetically adapted to those chemicals. So we either have to increase the dose or we have to come up with something else. We don't create the kinds of chemicals that we used to that biologically amplify within food webs that actually affect the organisms at the top of the food chain, like the peregrine falcon and the bald eagle and larger fish within oceanic ecosystems. So the statistics will vary. I mean, the pesticide industries have their own statistics, and then you have environmental organizations that have theirs. They may not always come together on that. So you have to consider that there's some variability there in the data. But we do know that we have sustainable methods that don't require fungicides, pesticides, rodenticides, by doing more polycropping as opposed to growing like one type of food product, in an area with several acres, and growing the same thing over and over and over again. So when you're growing multiple crops within a specific agricultural plot, you actually increase biodiversity. You reduce the need. You reduce the number of insects that are feeding on those crops, and it's healthier for the population. And again, it comes down to cost shifting. I didn't mention that. If we practice really good cost shifting, then everything that we make, any kind of a product that we buy, whether it's food or whether it's tobacco or whether it's a piece of furniture, to incorporate in that the full cost of what it takes to make something, okay?
The full cost of mechanized agriculture is astounding because it's killing
very much.
Yeah.
Right. And the same thing, like, for example, tobacco, instead of that pack of cigarettes costing only $4 or $5, it'd actually be a $15 to $20 when you calculate the medical expenses, the absenteeism in companies, tobacco-related illnesses, the cost of treating cancer patients and all that. Those things bring a kind of reality. And, of course, you're going to have some dissent on this because people don't want to see the prices go up. We're living in a time where there's a lot of inflation. Our economy is not in the best shape in the world. But in a way, we cannot afford not to do this because eventually what will happen is that biospheric functions, ecological systems, will be crippled to the point where they just can't produce to meet the needs of the population. And then when that happens, then what happens is ecosystems, or populations, I should say, have a dieback, and their population is reduced so that it comes into concert with the amount of available resources that are there for them to survive and live.
Agreed. I really appreciate your time and your efforts. Thank you very much.
Well, that's very kind of you, and thank you for calling.
Thank you for calling, Toby.
You bet. Bye.
And one of the things that I'd point out, too, is that when we talk about the cost, that ends up being borne by all of us through higher insurance premiums.
Absolutely.
And higher taxes. So those of us who are non-smokers are subsidizing the smokers.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay, and we do have our last break to do right now, and then we'll be back.
She meant me for someone exactly like you. 90.7 90.1 FM, supported by Kansas City Museum's Summer Concert Series, featuring Victor and Penny, Friday, May 8th, on the lawn of the Corinthian Hall, 7 to 9 p.m., 3218 Gladstone Boulevard. Antique pop duo Victor and Penny kicks off our Summer Concert Series, lending a modern voice to Prohibition-era jazz. All information at kcmo.gov/Kansas City Museum.
This is Wilson, and I'm one of the newest volunteers here at 90.1 FM KKFI. If you would like to get involved in volunteering, go ahead and call Bill at 816-994-7869 or go to kkfi.org/volunteer. Thanks for tuning in to 90.1 FM KKFI, your community radio station.
Okay, we are back with Biagio Pagano, and let's talked about a little bit about what more about individuals, what they can do at this local level as solutions to this.
Right, and even when we take actions at the local level, that will affect at the national level, and will have favorable impacts with the global environment, because we've got to remember everything is interconnected. So whatever we do here, even if it's small, will have a rippling effect.
I could just interrupt you for a second. Yes. And pick up that thought in a minute. We do have another caller on the line. Caller, if you could state your first name and where you're calling from.
My name is Arturo Del Cerda Art, and I'm calling Stephanie Shapti. She's at Leavenworth LDC.
All right, and what is your question?
I'd just like to send out a shout-out and just say that I love her and to keep her head up over there, and I was wondering if I could send a dedication song.
Call back after 7 o'clock. Thanks.
All right.
Getting back to what we can do to make a difference, because all this information is fine, it's good, a little scary, this kind of, but what can we do? So this is a little bit about empowerment, okay? Very quickly, let me just go through some ideas here that has worked, okay, and that's reduce energy and water needs. Think about the number of children that you want to have. Educate yourself and others. Recycle and reuse plastics, paper, and metals. Don't buy any furs, ivory products, or other items that are made from endangered animal species. Do not buy wood or wood products from tropical or old-growth forests. Don't buy animals or plants taken from the wild. Plant trees. Plant flowering plants to attract pollinating insects. Lower your meat consumption. Buy organically produced foods. Use less toxic and or non-toxic alternatives. Support environmental organizations like the Sierra Club. Become politically active at the local, state, and national levels, and support laws and treaties that protect biodiversity. And you have some wonderful people out there that are responsible. A lot of times they just don't get the press, okay, like press meaning the kind of media attention. Ray Anderson, he was the developer of the Interface Company out of Atlanta, Georgia. They are the largest manufacturer of carpet tiles in the world. He has 25 factories in 7 countries, and they have some very interesting things. What they've done is that they reduced their energy and matter resources and relied a lot on solar energy for their production. There has been a 74% decrease in water use, 32% reduction in greenhouse gases, 60% reduction in fossil fuels, 44% reduction in energy use. 31% of their energy comes from renewable sources. And the good news is that they have saved more than $433 million over several years. And their annual sales have increased by $1 billion, okay? And they're trying to do the right thing, and people are getting more and more aware of these kinds of individuals that are trying to make a difference.
Okay.
And so we don't always have to be at odds with making products or with corporations and businesses.
All right. We are just about out of time. We have a few seconds. Is there one to two websites that you would suggest people go to if they want to look for more information on this topic?
If you could go to your search field. In fact, I was talking to a couple of staff members here earlier. If you go to your search field and do a Google or Bing and type in 25 top environmental organizations / ECOIST, ECOIST, you will come up with the major organizations, what they are about, what they do, their successes, and how to be involved. And they provide really good resources for people of all ages.
All right. Well, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Biagio Pagano. And as a reminder, the show will be podcast. That means you can go online if you missed part of it and listen to it over the internet. And I'm turning this over. Natural E has our calendar.
Thanks, Craig. The EFC Grant Program. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announces the availability of funds and solicits applications from eligible entities for regional environmental finance centers, or EFCs, that provide multimedia environmental finance expertise and outreach to regulated communities. EPA recognizes that, given the trends of growing costs and increasing resource pressures, the need to support the environmental work of regulated communities through vehicles such as the regional environmental finance centers is as important and timely as ever. The EFCs will be established and supported in EPA regions across the country to provide regulated parties with finance-related training, technical assistance, finance studies, and other analytical support to help them develop sustainable solutions to the critical how-to-pay issues associated with meeting environmental standards and goals. Find out how and where to apply at www.epa.gov/envirofinance/EFC-grant-competition or find that link on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page. And the Environmental Management Commission promotes environmental awareness and resource efficiency to the city's leaders and staff to assist the progress of Kansas City towards sustainability. The general public is encouraged to attend and observe meetings and to join and participate in its efforts. The meeting is on Wednesday, the 13th of May, from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Mid-America Regional Council, Rivergate Center, second floor, 600 Broadway, KCMO. You can find more information about this meeting at kcmo.gov. And finally, on May 2nd, from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m., there's an Overland Park recycling extravaganza. Make plans to recycle just about anything you can on Saturday, May 2nd. It offers an opportunity to recycle more materials than ever before. So, again, this event is May 2nd from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Black and Veatch Campus, which is located at 114th and Lamar Avenue in Overland Park, Kansas. For more information, you can visit the Surplus Exchange online or contact Jim Twigg at jim.twigg@opkansas.org. And that's all.
Climate deniers school the Pope on climate change. That and other stories for the week ending April 26, 2015. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
On Tuesday of this coming week, Pope Francis and the Vatican are holding a workshop on global warming, and it's expected that the Pope will soon issue a statement about climate change.
According to The Guardian, the Pope has recently argued for a radical new financial and economic system to avoid human inequality and ecological devastation.
But some think the Pope may not have received all the information he needs to prepare his remarks. And to help him in that effort, a group of Americans is offering their advice.
The Heartland Institute, a conservative think tank that denies climate change, is sending a team of scientists to inform Pope Francis of the truth about climate science.
A spokesperson for the organization said that Catholics should examine the evidence for themselves and understand that the Holy Father is an authority on spiritual matters, not scientific ones.
The Heartland Institute denies that it's a front for any other group or industry, but The Guardian is reporting that Heartland has received funding from energy companies and a foundation controlled by Charles Koch.
Our hearts go out to all those who are suffering from the recent earthquake in Nepal. We hope for speedy rescue and recovery.
In news related to much less severe quakes, last week the USGS released a report about methods to predict hazardous ground shaking in areas of increasing seismic activity. The increase has been linked to the injection of drilling wastewater underground.
Most of the man-made quake activity is occurring in Oklahoma, and also last week the Oklahoma Geological Survey admitted that the sharp rise in quakes is very unlikely to come from a naturally occurring process.
The position of the state of Oklahoma was welcomed by some, who saw its earlier position as ignoring decades-old studies that concluded injection wells caused earthquakes.
In neighboring Kansas, the number of quakes has recently gone down, and some are hoping the decline is due to a state order a month ago setting a daily maximum amount of wastewater injection. But officials say it's too early to tell if the new regulations are reducing the number of quakes in Kansas. Scientists are always looking for new ways to test streams and rivers to determine the presence of harmful chemicals. Occasionally, that requires some out-of-the-box thinking.
Out of the feminine hygiene box, perhaps, David Lerner is an engineering professor at the University of Sheffield in England, and he's found a unique method of testing water, tampons.
The professor dangles them in water and then looks at them in the lab. He finds the material in tampons can show optical brighteners like those used in laundry detergents and shampoos that would signify contamination from various sources, including sewage.
As reported in the Smithsonian, Lerner found that after only 5 seconds of exposure to a very diluted amount of optical brightener, the tampon glowed in the dark. And speaking of pollutants, it's long been known that plastic bags harm birds and mammals because they often get tangled up in them.
Now, a new study by Danielle Senga Green of Trinity College in Dublin shows that marshlands that contain plastic bags have significant effects on small invertebrates and algae. Plastic bags decrease the amount of oxygen and lead to lower numbers of organisms in sediments than those without them.
The bags also create barriers, preventing sunlight and other nutrients from reaching the ground. It's dry in the West. How dry? Sailboats are being hoisted out of the Great Salt Lake because there's not enough water to prevent their keels from getting stuck in the mud.
About 80 boats will sit high and dry this summer because the lake's level is 18 feet below average and continuing to drop.
State park officials said that if Utah had had a better snowpack, they might have been putting boats in the water at this time of year. But low precipitation prompted the Utah legislature to set aside $1.5 million to dredge the public marina.
Sailboat owner Ron Lee told the Salt Lake Tribune that having his boat moved by a crane was the most action it had seen in a long time.
And there's action on the drought in California, too. Last Thursday, the state assembly passed a bill that would bar cities and counties from imposing fines for residents who let their lawns go brown during the governor's declared drought emergency.
Assemblywoman Cheryl Brown, who sponsored the bill, said numerous residents had contacted her complaining of fines for blight after not watering their lawns. The Southern California Democrat called it completely irresponsible for a municipality to penalize its residents for conserving water.
And finally this week, Darwin was a dropout. No, not that Darwin who gave us the origin of species. The other one.
Darwin, the Labrador Retriever, a spunky animal that sadly flunked service dog training in Texas. But instead of serving people, he's now following his nose to serve nature.
He and his buddy Neville, a black Labrador rescued from a shelter, were adopted by Dogs for Conservation, an organization that trains and provides dogs to assist in wildlife conservation, rangeland science, and habitat management.
The pair have been brought to the Galapagos Islands to sniff out the giant African snail, one of the world's most invasive and destructive species. The dog's ability to smell plant and animal life is proving to be an invaluable tool in environmental protection.
Not only do the duo work to eradicate the snails, but the Galapagos Biosecurity Agency is planning to have dogs work at airports and ports to protect the unique archipelago from other invasive species.
By the way, dogs aren't just working on land. They're helping researchers in water bodies, too. For example, their keen sense of smell is helping to track aquatic organisms invisible to the human eye in streams. The dogs are also helping to detect whale scat in the open ocean so scientists can learn more about whale diets and whether they're being affected by toxins.
So much for the expression, that dog don't hunt, because these dogs do.
Who let the dogs out?
This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at ColoradoWaterWise.org. But the money was not.